for Tuesday, February 13. Let me just kind of roadmap the agenda for you a bit. The work session that was scheduled on House Bill 2366 is going to be set over because there are some amendments that have been brought back to us that require a little bit more work, so we won't be working that bill yet today. We'll take the remainder of the agenda in the order in which it appears here on the notice of the meeting. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2382. Council Cummins.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2382 abolishes Oregon's conclusive presumption that a husband who is not impotent or sterile and who is living with his wife at the time of conception is the father of the child. The bill retains the rebuttable presumption that a husband is the father of a child born to his wife during the marriage, and creates a rebuttable presumption that a child born to an unmarried woman who is married within 300 days of the birth is the child of the former husband. It allows a court to exclude evidence offered to rebut the presumption if it is, quote, just and equitable to the parties, end quote, to do so. It permits the husband or wife, but not anyone else, so long as the husband and wife are living together, to challenge the paternity of the child in certain instances. It allows a party to a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, or the child or DHS in certain instances, to challenge the voluntary acknowledgement on the basis of fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact. It allows a court to set aside an acknowledgement if it finds by preponderance of the evidence that the acknowledgement was signed because of fraud, duress, or mistake, and it is, quote, just and equitable to the parties and the child, unquote, to do so. It allows a party 1 year to challenge a voluntary acknowledgement in an administrative proceeding and request a blood test if blood testing previously had not occurred at the time of the acknowledgement. It creates a procedure for petitioning a court to set aside a judicial order establishing paternity. The bill allows a party to challenge a paternity order based on fraud if the challenge is brought within a year of discovering the fraud. It allows a court to require the parties to submit to blood tests if it is just and equitable to do so. It gives a court the discretion to deny a paternity challenge even if it finds the paternity determination was obtained by fraud and blood tests establish that the man is not the biological father if the court finds that it is just and equitable to the parties and the child to do so. There are also -2 amendments that are before the committee, and my understanding that the primary difference between the -1 and the -2 amendments are the -2 would require a court to set aside a paternity judgment if it finds that the man is not the biological father and was defrauded into believing that he was.
Council, I see -1 amendments. Where do we have the -2s?
Do we have the -2s?
We don't have the -2s.
Is Matt Minahan here? Matt, do you have extra copies of the -2s?
Okay. Well, I'm not sure it's important for us. I think let's get into the issues here before we were getting those amendments out before us. I just wanted to make sure I knew where all the paper was. We have a number of witnesses who are signed up on House Bill 2382. I'd like to call forward a panel to begin with from the Oregon Law Commission, which brought this bill forward. And I see Sam Sears, Sandy Hansberger, Leslie Harris, and Russ Lupetsky. If there's space there for all four of you, why don't you sit down together and bring it.
Chair McPherson, sorry, if I could start, I was just going to introduce some of the members or some of the testimony, and then I'll take a seat and let them get into the details of the bill.
That would be fine.
For the record, Sam Sears, the Oregon Law Commission, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Law Commission. This is our first bill before the Judiciary Committee this session. Many of you are familiar with the Law Commission, but if you'd allow me just to say a few words, and then I will let the work group members and the experts here kind of talk more about the substance of the bill. House Bill 2382 was pre-session filed at the request of the Law Commission as a placeholder bill. As staff counsel Cummins described, the -1 amendments, and those do represent the recommendations of the Law Commission. A few notes on the Oregon Law Commission. You're probably aware the commission was created in 1997 to conduct a continuous program of law reform. And so this is our 10th year, 10th anniversary, so we're kind of happy about that. Been around for a little while now. The Law Commission is composed of 13 commissioners who represent the three branches of government, the academic community, and the private legal practice. And the commission draws from the knowledge and expertise of its distinguished commissioners and the many qualified, dedicated volunteers who make up the various work groups in order to provide recommendations to the Legislative Assembly. Each of our recommendations are accompanied by a report that describes the Commission's recommendations and the discussion that took place to reach these final recommendations. As you can see, the report's been provided for you over there as testimony. The Commission strives to be nonpartisan, focused on recommending good law reform for the state. This is the first of 10 bills that we expect to come before the House Judiciary Committee this session, and we thank you for taking the time to have a public hearing on this bill. Unless there are any questions about the Law Commission, I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce three of our work group members who will be providing the testimony on this bill.
Very good.
Okay. Sandra Hansberger, who's sitting to my right, is one of the 13 law commissioners, and she was a chair of the work group of this project. She was appointed by the Oregon State Bar in 1999. At the time of her appointment, she was a practicing lawyer and clinical law professor at the Lewis and Clark School of Law, where she supervised students in representing low-income clients. She's been a member of the bar since 1983, and she's chaired several projects for the commission, including administrative and judicial child support, welfare code reform, and judicial sales and judgments. Leslie Harris, who's sitting on my left, is a reporter for this project. She provided the report that you have before you today. She's the Dorothy Clicks Phones Professor of Law at the University of Oregon, where she has taught family law and other courses since 1982. She's a co-author of textbooks on family law and children in the law, which are widely used throughout the U.S. She's also written a number of law review articles about the legal rights of non-traditional families, family support duties, and property rights in divorce. She's an elected member of the American Law Institute. This is the second Oregon Law Commission project related to paternity laws for which she has been the reporter. And finally, Russell Lipetsky, who's sitting to my right, was a work group member on this project. He's admitted to the Oregon State Bar in 1987, and for the past 20 years has focused his practice in the general area of family law. He's the author and frequent speaker of family law issues and is an active volunteer. He's a current chair of the Oregon Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee and former chair of several committees, including the Oregon State Family Bar Law Oregon State Bar Family Law Section and Oregon Advisory Task Force on Parental Access and Visitation. In addition, Mr. Lipetsky was the recipient of the Oregon State Bar's President Membership Service Award and was the Marion Polk Legal Aid Pro Bono Lawyer of the Year. So without taking any more of the committee's time, I'd like to request that the chair invite these individuals up, which he's already done, and they can present the testimony for this bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sears. And so you can just fill in there so you have a microphone available to each of you. And I'll let you go in whatever order you think is optimum.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Sandy Hansberger, and as Sam Sears said, I am a member of the Oregon Law Commission and was the chair of this particular work group. I'm really here today just to give you a few minutes about the work group process. The work group consisted of about 40 individuals who served as members, either members of the work group, advisors to the work group, or interested parties. It was one of the largest work groups that the Oregon Law Commission has assembled to date. And the people brought to the table to discuss this important issue have a broad variety of backgrounds, representatives in state government, also private lawyers, and other individuals. In fact, they're outlined in the work group report, I believe, on page 2 and 3. We had over 20 meetings in the past year on this project. That does not include the many sub-work group meetings that we had. The result is a product that is has been the subject of much compromise throughout the work group process. And Professor Harris and Russ Lipetsky will describe that process a little bit more to you and frankly, the ending result and the subject matter of compromise. So that's all I have. Unless there are additional questions, I will turn it over to Professor Harris.
Let's hear from each person in the panel then, and then we can take questions in
okay.
the panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative McPherson and committee members, and thank you for hearing us today. My name is Leslie Harris. I'm a law professor at the University of Oregon, where I teach family law and children and the law, among other things, and head a child advocacy project. My job today is to basically give you the background and explain the principles of this law. I don't intend to go section by section, lest I put you sound asleep early this morning, though I'm very happy to answer any questions you have about particular provisions. As Sandy said, this bill deals comprehensively with issues concerning legal paternity. This is an area of the law that you can underlies so many aspects of people's lives, and that's a very important thing to remember, that we're drafting a law here, we're creating a law here for that's going to be applied in many contexts, everything from private custody disputes, private child support disputes, juvenile court cases involving abused and neglected children, adoption cases, child support enforcement cases. And so this is covering many, many, many areas. Inheritance law, it affects inheritance law. The last time that Oregon's paternity law was comprehensively revised was about 30 years ago. And it has been amended piecemeal since then, but it hasn't been looked at again. And over time, because of changes in social structure, families, and changes, scientific changes, as well as some legal changes, our current law doesn't work very well in certain respects. The issues that brought this legislation to the fore, brought this work group together, surrounded paternity disestablishment. That was the hot button issue. But there's a lot more going on than that. Let me briefly explain just sort of what's happened over the last 30 years and how it's caused dislocations. 30 years ago, when this bill was enacted, about 90% of all children were born to married women. And under the law of that time, including in Oregon, the father of those children was presumed to be the mother's husband. In Oregon, in fact, this presumption that the husband was the father was conclusive, which means even if you had evidence to the contrary, it could not be introduced. It was a rule of law that the husband was the child's father. And as a practical matter, because genetic testing was very primitive, nobody much asked anyway. The children who were born to unmarried mothers at that time, it was pretty uncommon to have paternity established. Once again, genetic testing wasn't very good. This is before the era of the child support program. Those children very often had no legal father. The upshot of this is that for most children had a legal father. That legal father was also the man who functioned as their father, what I call the social father. Most of the time he was also their biological father, but surely sometimes not. Over the last 30 years, things have changed that have caused disruption than this. First of all, many more children are born to unmarried women. Today, a third of all children are born outside marriage. A fourth to a half of these mothers live with the man believed to be the father when the child is born. But three-quarters to half don't, so that means lots of children are living in households without both parents, and many of these children don't automatically have a legal father because their mothers are unmarried. In addition, we have much more sophisticated genetic testing, as I'm sure you know, so that we can identify with near biological certainty who the father of a child is. And we have important changes in culture. We have a very aggressive and effective child support enforcement program, which includes as a major component enforcing paternity. which means that many unmarried fathers, paternity is being established, but they aren't living with their children. So they are legal fathers, but they are not children's social fathers. They are not functioning in a family as their fathers. Secondly, paternity can now be established without going to court for an unmarried father by the mother and the man believed to be the father signing a document called a voluntary acknowledgement. Once that's filed with the Bureau of Vital Statistics, it has the legal effect of a court order of paternity. You do not have to take a blood test to sign a voluntary acknowledgement, and in fact, federal law precludes states from requiring a blood test. It's available, but it's not required. Furthermore, part of the child support enforcement program is that there is a very effective and aggressive program of administration determinations of paternity for children born to unmarried mothers where there's not a voluntary acknowledgement. Very often these administrative determinations, which result in orders, administrative orders of paternity that are turned into court orders, are entered without blood tests having been done, either because the man thinks he's the father or because he simply defaults, doesn't ever show up. The result is that you've got a number of situations. You've got a large category, a large part of the population, where you've got men who are identified as legal fathers, who sometimes may not be biological fathers because they think they are, but the genetic testing hasn't been done. And many of them don't have the ties to the children from living with them, and so don't have that allegiance. And the result is the paternity disestablishment challenges that I mentioned. The fundamental legal and social problem that all this raises is the relative importance to determining legal paternity of biology versus social functioning as a father. One thing that I think is important for you to know as you think about this is that actually the so far as we can tell from national and state data, this isn't a huge problem. We don't have, you know, hundreds of thousands of men identified as legal fathers who are not biological fathers, even though you hear a lot of publicity. National data, the most recent national study, which I found, shows that 98% of the men who are raising children that they believe to be their biological children are correct. And 30% of the men who seek blood tests to confirm paternity are not the biological father. The other 70% are. Oregon data coming from the vital records section and the child support enforcement program shows that in less than 1% of all cases in which paternity is established by voluntary acknowledgement were judicial orders of disestablishment entered, so less than 1%. This data also shows that in the 2.5 years between fiscal years 2004-2005 and half of 2006, there were 27,500 cases in which paternity was established by voluntary acknowledgement of the 27,500 cases in which voluntary acknowledgement established paternity, someone filed a request with the state to reopen in 79 cases. So 79 out of 27,500. And in only about 20 of these was the man not the biological father. So actually this is a small problem statistically. It's not to say that it's important, but it's important to remember that we're creating a law that also applies to all those people who are matched up, if you want to say correctly, biologically and legally, and we're creating a law that it's important for it to work for them effectively, smoothly, and without a lot of problems. With regard to the current law, I'm going to tell you now a little bit about current law on the issues that we're talking about and the changes that the Law Commission is making to you and the reasons. And I think it's important to affirm, as Sandy told you, this was a very long process. This was a hard-working group of people. If the state of Oregon had to pay all these lawyers to do all this free work, we would have gone broke. I mean, you had the deans of the family law bar. I was really impressed. You had high administrators from DHS. You had, you know, the best people in the state working on this and working hard on this. And this bill is a compromise at several critical levels. First thing is, as I've suggested, but now I'll make clear, there are three ways that paternity can be established. Most commonly, the marriage presumption, presumed that the husband is the father of his wife's children. For unmarried women, the most common way that paternity is established now is by that voluntary acknowledgement procedure that I told you about. And then the third way is by an administrative or court order. So I'm going to talk about each one of these separately, tell you what the law is, tell you what we're proposing to change and why. First of all, the presumption that the husband is the father of his wife's children. As I told you, Oregon law provides, and it's the only state in the country at this point that has this strong a presumption, provides conclusively that a husband is the legal father of his wife's children if they were married and living together when the child was conceived. The Law Commission unanimously recommending that that conclusive presumption be abolished. The reason is fundamentally that the source of that rule was partly lack of good genetic testing and social constructs. And those things have changed now. There's no longer really a justification for an absolute ban on challenges to the presumption. The work group was we are very concerned about protecting intact families, protecting families where the husband and wife are raising children together. And we didn't want them to be, that family to be attackable by outsiders. Someone, for example, who claims he's the father of the children. And we also didn't want to have indefinite stability on these. We considered having a time limit on challenges, as some states do. It was a compromise of the Law Commission not to have a time limit. There were a substantial number of people who wanted to do a time limit. We compromised. We are recommending that there still be a rebuttable presumption of paternity born for any child born to a married woman. And we want to recommend that if the mother and the husband are living together raising the children, no one outside may challenge the presumption unless the husband and wife both agree. That's to protect that family. As between the husband and wife, they may challenge it. So the restriction is so long as they're together. Once the family is no longer intact, if they're not living together anymore, the ban on third-party challenges would be removed. We are also recommending, and this is minor, but I'll just mention it, that there be a presumption that a child born to a woman who was previously married, but within 300 days of the time she is no longer married, her husband dies or they get a divorce, that the child be presumed to be the husband's. Right now we don't have any assumption about this. I am told by family law practitioners that's how they act. And it's likely to be true, and it's a presumption that can be rebutted. This is a very old presumption. Lots of states have had it for a long time. It's kind of in the nature of a cleanup, actually. The second way that paternity can be established is by this voluntary acknowledgement procedure. State law requires, state and federal law require that either party be allowed to rescind it for any reason within 60 days. So after 60 days, it's final, unless, and this is the second way it can be challenged, a party to that, a man or woman, can challenge at any time for fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact, as can the child, and DHS, if the child is in DHS custody as an abused or neglected child. In addition, for up to a year after the voluntary acknowledgement, if there were no blood tests, a party can go to the administrative agency or a court to get blood tests, and if the blood tests show he's not the father, then the order for disestablishment of paternity can be sought. The first thing that the work group recommends is to create an explicit statutory process for challenging voluntary acknowledgments. The real reason for this is that we are told, particularly by the Child Support Enforcement Office, that many individuals are representing themselves or going through this process by themselves, and they just need things spelled out in the statute for them. So that's the purpose of creating the process. We also recommended that there be no time limit, as I said. We rejected the idea that voluntary acknowledgments should automatically be invalid if the man's not the biological father. We rejected the idea that fraud should be defined because fraud is well defined in the case law, and we wanted to leave that to the judges. Another important thing that's in here, it's a small but important thing, is that once a parent has relinquished a child to be adopted or had parental rights terminated, they can't sign a voluntary acknowledgement. That ought to seem obvious, but it's not clear, and there have been some unfortunate situations where adoptions have been derailed by late filing voluntary acknowledgments, and so that's the purpose of that. The third way that paternity can be established is by an administrative order turning into a court order or a court order of paternity. There's a well-established legal procedure for that. There is no specific process for challenging court orders of paternity has been left to general legal processes that are used for challenging judgments. The work group is recommending the creation of an explicit statutory process, once again, to accommodate people who are trying to handle this by themselves without a lawyer. Challenges may be made based on mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect, have to be filed within 1 year, which is consistent with general law. And a challenge brought on fraud, misrepresentation, or other misconduct must be brought within a year from the date of discovery, also consistent with general law. The last topic that I want to talk about is this broader question of the extent of judicial discretion to deny petitions to disestablish paternity or to deny petitions to have blood testing done. Under current Oregon law, a court may refuse to allow that marital presumption of paternity to be challenged when it's rebuttable, and it may allow to refuse to set aside an order of paternity even in the face of evidence that the man is not the biological father, if the person who wants to bring the challenge is equitably estopped from doing so, meaning that he or she has made representations that are that people have relied on and that are inconsistent with now bringing a challenge. And that's standard Oregon law. It's standard law everywhere. The work group essentially proposes to retain this discretion and to add that discretion for the voluntary acknowledgement challenges under the new procedures. There was a minority view on the work group that said biological paternity should control under all circumstances. They framed the issue as being almost a gender war issue, issue of fairness between the mother and the father, and particularly focused on the cheating woman who has done her man in, which is sometimes the true story. The majority of you said, you know, this law, these issues are much, much broader than that. They apply in many more circumstances. It's not always men who are the ones done wrong. It is critical. We cannot draft a law that will be sufficiently detailed for the myriad circumstances when paternity is challenged and when you would or wouldn't want to allow it. And the critical thing to do in that circumstance, or the essential thing to do in that circumstance, is to give judges discretion, as justice and equity to the parties and the child require, to enter an order that is consistent with those interests. This is the standard way that these complex issues dealing with the individual quirks of individual families are handled in family law. Family law is full of these standards that say judges have discretion to tailor things to individual cases. So this is very typical of what we do and what other states do with regard to this kind of case. It is also what you generally do in the law when you have a very complex situation and you really can't draft specific rules for everything. So this is a very normal kind of solution. Even the language that's proposed to you is a compromise. The model act that we were working off of, the Uniform Parentage Act, explicitly says judges can refuse to allow paternity challenges in the cases we're talking about for equitable estoppel reasons, for latches. And they also say judges can refuse to allow challenges when it's contrary to the best interests of the child, and they spell out what best interests of the child means. There were a number of people on the work group who really wanted to have that kind of stuff in the bill and to lay it all out very clearly. There was opposition to this, particularly concern about the best interests of the child language, that would make judges think about the children too much. And so the language that you have, just and equitable to the parties and the child, was hammered out mostly by our worthy chair and Mr. Lepetsky over many months. I cannot tell you how many times we talked about this. And so that's my explanation of the bill. I'm prepared to answer any questions after he speaks that you would like. So thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Mr. Lepetsky.
Thank you. Sure. McPherson, members of the committee. I apparently, at a meeting that I wasn't at, got the short straw drawn on being able to sit here out of all 40 of us and speak to you, and I'm pleased to do so. But I don't claim to be a paternity expert. I'm a general family law practitioner, but I've been doing it for a while now, and I've had over the years occasion to have folks come in on just about all sides of this issue to my office at one time or another with one complaint or another. Whether it's a mother who says, gee, after 15 years of marriage, he's now claiming we're getting divorced and that the kid's not his. To the father who says, gee, after 10 years, we're getting divorced, my wife looked at me and snickered and said, guess what, the kid's not yours. So we really see these things a lot over the years, and as you've heard, it's been a good long time before there's been a real comprehensive review of the statute that controls all these things, and this work group, I think, did a real commendable job in doing that and bringing together a really incredibly diverse group of folks representing a lot of different interests. I was told that one of the reasons I was asked to be up here talking is because there's an ugly rumor that I'm balanced, and I don't know if that's true or not, but I have seen, I think, all sides of this issue, and I appreciate the work that this work group went in to crafting this bill that really is truly a compromise of a lot of different competing issues. As you just heard from Professor Harris, historically, the marital status was what controlled determination of the basic question, being, who's your daddy? And as our science has progressed and technology has progressed and we have genetic testing that pretty much takes a lot of the guesswork out of it, the question of who's your daddy becomes one of much more science but still certainly has enough vestiges of policy considerations and issues that it becomes a bit problematic in some areas. What we're looking at in this bill is to obviously shift the focus from things like marital status and shift the focus to, for the most part, biology. And when I say for the most part biology, it really gets to the kernel of the basic policy dispute that will be before you in the commission's bill, the dash ones and the dash twos. The commission looked at competing interests of everyone involved. That would be the mother, that would be the child, that would be the man who has believed he is the father, who may or may not biologically be the father. That may be the man who has not been established as father. That may be a man who has been wrongfully accused of being the father. That may be a man who is the husband, who may or may not be the father. So we have all these folks to look at, and the question before our work group was, should biology, in all cases, trump all other considerations? Do we say that once we know for sure who the biological father is, all other considerations go out the window, and that's the end of the story? If it means undoing paternity of a 14-year-old child or establishing paternity for a 14-year-old child or any age. And the majority of the work group felt that that ought not to be the case, that there ought be circumstances, and there probably would be circumstances, in which somebody, a judge being the most appropriate person, should be able to look at a case and say, you know, under these circumstances, in this particular case, even though there may be a blood test, or there could be a blood test if allowed, a genetic test, that would establish with certainty who the biological father is, because of real practical, equitable considerations for this family, we're just not going to have it happen. We're just not going to undo paternity either, and I'm making this up. There's 1,001 anecdotal scenarios you could come up with, but it's particularly, I think, where there are older children who for years and years have operated under the assumption that this person is their father, has been the one taking them to Little League games and everything else for years, and do we allow someone to come into court because of a divorce or whatever reason after that period of time and say, look, I've got the blood test, end of story, undo my child support obligation, undo everything else, and everybody go home. And we felt that wasn't appropriate. We felt that There should be discretion for the court to look at those situations, and that is really the kernel of the policy dispute that's going to be before you today. I can tell you in my experience that in family law matters in particular, it's rarely the case that one size fits all, and that's why this element of judicial discretion I think is so important, because you can't say that for every family the outcome should be the same simply as a result of something like a genetic test that establishes paternity or not. So that's really what I have to say. I don't claim to be an expert on every procedural aspect of the bill. Professor Harris is much better to do that than I am. But I was a member of the work group, and I heard a lot of the discussion, and I am a family law practitioner. And so between the three of us and the many other witnesses you have coming before you today, I think we can answer, hopefully, your questions. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation, and thank you for the work of the commission and been devoting so many hours to this difficult area of the law. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I guess you can probably blame me, and I think if you recall last session, Matt Manahan came to my office, and he was pretty well up against a block wall where people didn't want to look at this issue because of the difficulty of it, and it looks like what we handed you was a monumental effort that you completed, and I really can't express how much I appreciate it because it affects a lot of people. I believe Ronell Schenkel, Wendy was in my office. I asked them to try to find justice and fairness, and it would be hard to do depending on what was it, the mother, the child, what are all these different values and positions that you're trying to deal with. And I think you've done, you know, I haven't gone through this bill word for word yet, but it was a real effort that you've made, and I think you've made a good step in the fact that these laws haven't been reviewed for, what, you said 30 years nearly? It was time to make that first step, and we need to do it again. When we leave something set for that long, like land use, how we got 37, it's the same thing. If we don't go back and review, update, and now that we have new technology, I'm interested to see what the other committee members and the other people that are going to testify today have to say about your effort. But thank you very much.
Other questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Harris, I just was wondering, I read a case a while back where a lesbian couple had artificial insemination, and if, for example, if my wife and I did that, I would be the presumed father when the baby is born. But yet, for a lesbian couple, they didn't allow that. They had to, the non-mother would have to actually go through formal adoption proceedings. I wonder if you had time to address that in this overall comprehensive reform.
Thank you, Representative Barker. No, this bill does not address the charge to the work group from the Law Commission explicitly said do not discuss in this assisted reproduction and artificial insemination and all those sorts of issues. They're very much out there. Any law, in the absence of law about that, which Oregon's got a little bit of case law and a little bit of statutory law on that, but not a lot. I mean, a paternity law may have implications for that. But this bill does not explicitly address that at all.
Thank you very much.
And Representative Barker, if I might add, I'm sure glad that we didn't try to take that issue on as well. I'm sure we would never be here today with anything to
do. We would be back in 6 years, perhaps.
Right. Maybe something in the future for the Law Commission. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Harrison, it's just a statistical observation that you had made. You were talking about the national data showing 98% of men raising children are determined to be the biological fathers. And you said 30%, and I couldn't remember.
I said 30% of the men who seek blood tests. So this is a different group of peoples. I mean, they would kind of be overlapping like this. I mean, some of these men might be raising their children. Some men might not be. But of all the men in the country who seek blood tests, trying to figure out whether or not they are or are not actually the biological father of a child that they're the legal father of, 30% are not, 70% are.
Thank you.
Representative Chair McPherson, if I may, a final comment. Thank you. The family law section of the Oregon State Bar is comprised of approximately 1,100 attorneys throughout the state who practice family law and in diverse fields and all over the state. The family law section of the Oregon State Bar and on up through the bar and the bar's board of governors have all become familiar with this bill and all support the Dash 1 amendment. So I've been, even though I'm not here on behalf of the bar per se, I've been authorized and asked to convey to this committee that the family law section of the bar and the Oregon State Bar does support the Dash 1 amendments.
And panel, I think it might be helpful for the committee to have one of you just describe what it means to be a rebuttable presumption. That is, what kind of evidence could be brought forward then to establish an absence of paternity?
A rebuttable presumption is a rule, it's an evidence rule that says when we have a disputed issue, here's the starting point. Here's what we assume to be true. But someone who doesn't like that outcome can present evidence to show it's not true. So it's a rule about evidence. So that's what a rebuttable presumption is. So a rebuttable presumption that the husband is the father of his wife's children is an evidence rule that says the husband is the father of his wife's children. If no one challenges it, that's the answer. And that's what happens in the great majority of the cases. For those of you who are married and fathers, that's how come you're legal fathers. The kind of evidence that can be admitted theoretically is anything that's probative. Most of the time in contested paternity cases, it would be genetic testing evidence, and it would have to be done by a certified lab and that sort of thing. I can tell you in the old days before genetic testing, what they did, they'd hold up the baby and say, doesn't he look just like him? They really would, actually. They would do things like that. But in this case, you're mostly talking about genetic evidence.
And Chair McPherson, if I might add, in the case of the extension that we have for the 300 days right after marriage, so we're extending that marital presumption to a child who's born 300 days after the marriage ends. Some people have raised the issue about whether or not, how could you rebut that presumption, particularly in the case where the husband dies. Certainly, there can be other genetic testing may still be available even if there's a death. There could also be evidence if there was a divorce that there was no access and that the parties had not resided together or had any kind of sexual contact during that period of time. So that type of evidence would also be admissible in addition or in lieu of genetic testing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your work and your presentation. Let me describe where we're headed here. We've got a number of other people who are signed up. What I'm planning to do is to go next to Matt Minahan, who worked within the Law Commission effort. Then there's one witness signed up who came from more than 100 miles, Patty Albuso, if I'm reading that correctly. Then I'm going to go back to the top of the list and take the others who signed up in the order in which they signed up. So, Mr. Minahan.
Good morning. Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent Dads America, and I was a member of the Oregon Law Commission that studied the issue of paternity challenges and establishment. I do want to say I disagree with one thing that was said. Paternity fraud is a major problem across the country. As if you can look at that data, and I'll explain that data a little bit, 30% of all men who have challenged a voluntary, after signing a voluntary acknowledgement form, has challenged that acknowledgement. 30% are found not to be the father. And you have to keep in mind, prior to this bill, they weren't allowed to challenge after a one-year period in many of the states. And to put this in perspective for you, over 25,000 voluntary acknowledgement forms were signed last year in the state of Oregon. By Dad's America's calculation, and for example in the state of California, there are 4 million paternity fraud victims. So it is, I mean, I disagree with that, it is a major issue. And I do want to point out, although I'm officially signed up opposed to the Dash 1 Amendment, the Oregon Law Commission did do an enormous task. They did a fantastic job. We all worked very hard, and yes, I'll be the first to say there was plenty of compromises made. I just feel they made an error in one policy decision that I'm not comfortable with, and that I will bring to your attention here. And in fact, I'll go as far as to say if you ask me if Dash 1 Amendment is much better than the bill I brought before you last session, Senate Bill 234, I would say absolutely yes. I mean, they have solved, the Oregon Law Commission has solved many of the problems that Dad's America were concerned with. So again, they did a fantastic job. The Dash 2 amendment is nearly identical to the Dash 1 amendment proposed by the Oregon Law Commission with the following exceptions. The Dash 2 requires the court to set aside a voluntary acknowledgement form of paternity and a judgment in sections 1 and 9 if the challenge was brought by a man who signed the acknowledgement and can prove the acknowledgement was signed on the basis of fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact. In other words, you can prove fraud. The petitioner must also have blood tests showing that he is not the biological father. And one correction, we are not saying biology trumps all. We are tying things into that. We are tying fraud into that. When you have biology that says you're not the father, and you can prove that that acknowledgement was signed by fraud, and that you do in fact want out, we do have fathers that have discovered fraud and then want the relationship to continue. The Dash 2 deals with the men who can prove fraud and who no longer want to have paternity established and want to get out. Fraud, duress, and material mistake of fact are defined for the purpose of Section 1 only. Also, in Section 9, the courts are directed to order blood tests if the petitioner is a man whose paternity determination was based on fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact. Fraud and material mistake of fact are not defined in that section. Dad's America feels these changes are necessary for a few reasons, one of which is fraud. In every instance where the court is directed to release paternity without considerations to the party and the child, it is in cases where the paternity fraud victim no longer wishes to have paternity established, can prove he is not the biological father of paternity, and the paternity was, again, established on the basis of fraud. The Dash 1 amendment, and this is where we have a problem with the Dash 1, although fraud can be proven without question, there is no question whether fraud can be proven here. You sign that form on the basis of fraud or mistake or duress. It allows other considerations which bar the petitioner from being granted relief from paternity. In my view, this actually rewards fraud. There are no other areas in the law I know of that fraud is rewarded and that the perpetrator is actually rewarded and the petition to pay child support and the child support monies are actually paid to the perpetrator of the fraud. So you are in fact rewarding the fraud. Again, this is if fraud of course can be proven. The father and the child are both victims of paternity fraud, and we must focus the attention on the victims, not on the victims, but on the perpetrator of the fraud. We must not allow fraud to be rewarded, and we must not allow fraud to become a pathway to success in our court system. Another compelling reason why Dad's America has issue with the Amendment 1 is because we believe it's in violation of federal law. You have a packet that I provided this morning. On page 2 of the packet, there is the Title 42 of U.S. Code. And if we can read that, the federal definition states that after a 60-day rescission period, the states must allow a challenge to a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity only on the basis of fraud. In other words, if you can prove fraud, and on the basis of fraud alone, you should allow a challenge or duress, material mistake of fact. By adding best interest considerations into this, I believe, again, we are in violation of the federal law, which states only on the basis of fraud, duress, and material mistake of fact. Now, if I can, and also in the packet, on the next page of the packet, let me direct your attention to the Oregon Law Commission minutes prepared by Sam Sears, dated December 18, 2006. On the back page, there's an underlined passage here that says, and I quote, "The work group agreed, however, to eliminate judicial discretion if it was later determined to violate federal law." So my question, I mean, there's certainly a question whether this is in violation. One, we disagree with the policy decision. We don't like rewarding fraud. I mean, we can stand there and say, you've been frauded. That's without question. You've been frauded, and it's terrible to be you. We feel bad. However, we're going to allow this fraud to continue and force you to pay child support even when you don't want to. Secondly, there is certainly a question. I'll be honest, there are some attorneys on the other side who say, no, this is not in violation of federal law. There are some that say it is. My point is it's certainly in question. So why would we vote for something that may in fact rewards fraud and may be in violation of federal law? The Dash 2 amendments, we feel, solve that. However, at the last minute, we do understand kind of a need for compromise. Again, there were a lot of compromise made. It was pointed out to me by someone that there was some errors in the Dash 2, quite frankly, and I was more than happy to entertain those differences, and I agree with some of the changes that were proposed. You'll see those changes on the final page of your packet, and they were actually presented by Larry Gorin, who was also a member, and I believe who's going to speak today as well, speak to you. Those changes, and I apologize for not having time to get those in the Dash 2. They did come in late. There was a final hour discussions on that, and again, I agreed with those changes, so I think those will come back to you before you in the form of Dash 3. I will say with these changes, we do make some compromises and some acknowledgments that perhaps judicial discretion could be used in some of these cases. And so we do provide an out, and I think the Dash 3, once they are prepared in the Dash 3, will bring the Dash 2 and the Dash 1 even closer. With that, I close. I do, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to entertain questions. I did bring a wife of a paternity fraud victim here that's going to speak to you about what it's like, life as a paternity fraud victim and how that is. And I'd be more than happy to answer questions now or after she speaks.
And I take it that's not Patty Albuso?
It's Patty Albano. Sorry.
Albano.
Albano.
Yeah, and Ms. Albano, you are signed up on this list here, and indicated you had come from more than 100 miles. So I was going to take you next, if you. So, are there any questions for Mr. Minahan before we?
Just
Representative Krieger.
Matt, the scenario that you and I talked about, where a man is a victim of fraud, family separates, and he's paying child support, and then she marries the actual guy who is the father, so he's in the house with the mother and is receiving maybe child support for two or three children, that he is actually the father but has no obligation to them and someone else does. And that's what I thought about rewarding fraud. Maybe for 10 or 12 years of child support, to me, we need, if that's happening, we need to fix it.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, yes, in those cases, and we do have cases like that, as you know, I'm one of them. I became a lobbyist because of that exact same issue. That was my story. In those cases, if they could prove, I mean, if you can prove fraud and the judge has discretion and can prove it is not just and equitable to do so to the children or to the parties involved, you could have a situation where that man, and Dash 1, I believe I solved that in the Dash 2, which will soon be the Dash 3, is solved. That is not solved, in my opinion, in Dash 1. You could have a case where the judge still orders child support and continue to pay child support. And a thing to point out, we did look at the Oregon Law Commission looked at the relationship between the father and the child, which Dads America agrees that is very important. One thing I've point out, like I brought Steve Foley before you last session, and he had a case where he walked away, and I think we all disagreed with his choice there of walking away from the child. But if the father decides to do that, no matter what you and I write or legislate in the law, the father is going to do that. To answer your question, yes, you could have a case where that father, or presumed legal father, is ordered to pay child support and continue those payments.
Mr. Manahan, I want to make sure that I understand where the point of sort of divergence is between the majority of the Law Commission group and your perspective. Is it whether the when there has been an acknowledgement, whether the court has discretion to set it aside or not?
Yeah, I tried to narrow the field as much as possible. We agree with this discretion in cases where the mother's the petitioner, where the father wants to continue the relationship, but in cases where the father is the petitioner, in other words, I'm the petitioner, obviously you put me in a box, right? You said I was in a paternity box, and I want out of that box. I have to do a few things to get out of that box. One, I have to want to get out, and that's where I said when the father's the petitioner, which will be changing. We think we have some equal protection issues there. It'll be when the petitioner is the one who signed the form. In other words, the father. So when the father wants to get out, he has to do a few things. He can't just get out. We don't want fathers jumping in and playing dad. If he knew when he got in the box, if he knew there was some question, and then we don't let him out. We don't want fathers playing father and leaving. Fathers who are in the box, who want out, who can prove they got in the box by fraud. In other words, material mistake of fact or duress. Somebody lied to him. Somebody made a mistake. For all purposes, he thought he was the biological father. He is not. And so in those cases where he wants out, he can prove fraud, we don't want any other considerations. You will, however, that being said, in the dash three, you will see some cases where we agree with, we will give back a little judicial discretion. But is that very narrow field. He has to prove fraud, which is not an easy thing to do, by the way. And so that's why for the purpose of the section of voluntary acknowledgement forms, we kind of defined what fraud is. We'd be open if the opposition had difficulty with my definition of fraud or the definition I propose in fraud. I'd be more than happy to sit down and talk about what we could put in there. But I did, for the purpose of that section, define what fraud, duress, and material mistake of fact are. Not an easy thing to do. And, of course, he's got to have blood tests saying he's not the father. He could want out of the box. He could have been, I don't see how you could prove fraud, but maybe he thinks there was fraud, and then the test comes back and says, you're the dad, you're actually the biological father, case closed, you are the father.
Okay. If there are no further questions, let's hear from Ms. Albano. Start out by identifying yourself for the record.
Well, my name's Patty Albano. I'm a realtor in Oregon City. My husband's a mechanic, and he would have loved to be here today, but he couldn't take off from work because of the inclement weather. He missed a lot during this January season. If you'll just bear with me, I'd like to just speak out for fraud victims today. I am very emotional about this because it's been 30 years of living hell. In 1972, my husband was 17. He had a one-night stand with a girl from high school. She named him and another boy as being the father. And he went in and talked to the child support people. They had contacted him. He went in and he denied that he was the father. The dates didn't line up quite right for him. And they, handed him some paper and he crumpled it up and threw it on the desk of the secretary. I guess it really upset him as he was going out the door. In 1977, 6 years later, they waited to go after him. So we had been married. We had children of our own. And they decided, now we're going to make you the father. Well, he wasn't served papers at our home or anything. He was served papers at his place of employment. And he went down to talk to the district attorney's office and basically tried to get an extension because of financial difficulties. And they said that they would not allow him to have an extension. They just didn't trust him. Now, this was before DNA. They had the enzyme test then. So they made him the father by default. It took him a little bit longer to scrape up the money. He got an attorney. This attorney, in turn, was not a good attorney. He did not... My husband went and had the blood test, but this attorney didn't coordinate the mother and the child getting theirs. The court wasn't forcing her to do it, or I don't know, what happened, how the ball got dropped. But obviously, this attorney didn't do his part to represent us. He actually didn't show up on our court date. He didn't tell us of the court date. And so, therefore, they made him the father and closed the doors on him and locked the key. And it took us another year to scrape up the money to contact and hire another attorney, Mr. James Banks. And he went to court for us, and he tried to get the default set aside. And my husband, just to tell you financially where we were, my husband was serving papers for him on the side just to pay for his services. I mean, we had three children at home. We just didn't have the money. Every attorney we went to, and I'm not real fond of attorneys, and I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings, but, you know, everybody wants $5,000.
I'm likely to cheer.
You know, we won't even talk to you. We want our $5,000 first, and then we'll talk to you. And we've had four attorneys in the 30 years that we've been fighting this, and three of those attorneys took our money. One didn't do anything for us. Two of them said, we can't do a thing for you. And the second attorney that we had really fought hard for us. We went to court January 20th. I'll never forget it because it was my birthday, and I think that was about 1979. It was about a year after he had gotten shot down the first time. And they said, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Albano, but, you know, you've had plenty of time to prove your case, and we're just not going to hear your case. We're done with you. So pay your child support and be done. Well, our attorney said at that time, he said, well, you can try to get her to have the DNA test. So I remember one day we went over to her house. She was living with her parents, very pregnant, 5 p.m., drunker than a skunk, and called the police on us. So that was the end of us trying to get the DNA results on our own, you know, in a kind way to get her to maybe step up to the plate. From then on, I started calling welfare fraud because she was on welfare. She was getting child support for three children. They had three different fathers. She didn't have custody of the children. Her ex-husband had the custody. She was living with her current boyfriend at his parents' house, and they owned a little restaurant in Whittier, California. And the reason why I know this is because I went to high school with all these people. I know that she also tried to accuse another young man, Bill Joe, before my husband, because my mom and her were roommates, and she told my mom that this woman tried to get him first. So why the system fell down and let him down, I don't know. If it was me, I would have lined these young men up in the same room and said, who's the father? We're all going to test you. And, you know, I don't know if they held, you know, everybody had to have their own individual case, and they had to handle it case by case, but it just didn't seem fair to us. We never got our day in court. Nobody ever stood up for him and said, you know, here's this test, we're going to help you out. All they did was say, you're the victim, we've got you, you're going to pay. And she committed fraud. She lied about it. So a couple years ago, in 2004, while this woman was in a drug rehab, her son and got a hold of us through a man that was best man at our wedding that we went to high school with. And he told us that this boy wanted to find out who his father was finally. Now, this boy was 32 years old when we went to court last year. So, you know, he's not a boy anymore. He's a grown man who doesn't need our support. I would say my husband and I have paid out $60,000 in attorneys and child support that they have taken from him. And on top of that, he owed about $85,000 in past support.
Yeah. Ms. Albano, I had actually moved you up based on your indication you live more than 100 miles, and so you were kind of late on the sign-up as compared to a number of other people who had signed up. So if you could bring it to a conclusion here so we can move on to some other witnesses, that'd be helpful.
Okay. They got together. They agreed to have a DNA test. He had his from down there. My husband had his from up here. Found out he is not the father. It took us 2 years after that to get into court because the courts are so backed up in Los Angeles. I wrote, and my husband wrote, every senator in the state of California to try to get this bill passed, AB 252, that if you could prove by DNA that you're not the father, that they would just let you go. And last year, January 25th, we had our day in court. And, you know, the judge smiled at us, and that was all we ever got. I did not get, we're sorry, you know, we're sorry this happened to you. No apology, nothing. I mean, all this time has gone by where we've been garnishing and, you know, you can't imagine when you're a victim of fraud how hard it is to keep on coming up with this money that you don't have. Your family looks at you like, you're working, pay it. Well, when it takes away from the money that you're using to support your kids, I'm the victim. My kids don't have college money. We don't have retirement put away because all of our money in the hardest years of my husband's life, his working years, were spent paying for somebody else's kid that wasn't his. And he never got a chance to say, it's not mine, because the courts just slammed the doors on him They believed her. You know, I only saw her the one time. I mean, she was never in court. I don't know. How do they get away with this? There's got to be some kind of rules or some kind of procedures in place to protect people like us from being fraud victims. I mean,
Ms. Albano, are there any questions for this witness? And thank you, Mr. Minahan and Ms. Albano. Next, we've got Carlos Diaz from Marion County.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Carlos Diaz. I reside in Kaiser, Oregon. As you know, I'm here to talk about the House Bill 2382 and a part of it that I oppose. I am a father of a daughter who was born to a married woman. And currently that law, as it's been explained already, does not recognize my rights as her father at all, even though I'm willing to, wanting to take part in her life, provide the support she needs, and ensure that her safety and her well-being is cared for properly. And yet I am denied that right. Now, although the law was written that way, last year I challenged it in court. I challenged it because I do believe in my right as a father and my daughter's right to know who I am and to have that relationship with each other. I had pretty good success with it. The ultimate outcome was that it would not recognize my right. The attorney threatened to go to the appeals court. As we know, the appeals court looks at nothing but the law. So there's no way for me to get beyond that. So now I'm here before you as a father asking you guys for the opportunity to give me a chance to be a father to my daughter. The bill that is before you says the only time I can challenge this is if they are divorced. That could be 10 years from now. I've lost 10 years of my daughter's life, 10 years of getting to know who she is and getting to know who I am. My concerns as a father are these are in regards to her mother. Her mother was raised experiencing abuse at different levels. And the question for me has always been, how do I know if history will repeat itself on my own daughter? And if I have to wait till she's an adult to finally meet her, and for me to find out that she experienced some type of abuse, what do I say to her? I'm sorry. The law would not let me be a part of your life. And there's really nothing I can say to her. She was born in 2005, and to this day I have not met her. I've come to find out she has medical issues. When we asked what those medical issues were, the response was, and I quote, "I have no legal right to her." I work in the medical field roughly 10 of the past 12 years, and with the advances in medicine, I can not put enough emphasis as to how important one's medical history and past family medical history is for a diagnosis and treatment. And for a child, my daughter, it's an advantage that she deserves to have. So, as I stated, I'm here as a father before you, asking you for an opportunity, for that opportunity to be a father to my daughter. I'm not here because I want to put one up on her mother, fight custody. No, I'm here to be an advocate for her, speak on her behalf in case of her safety and well-being are not met at the utmost level. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Diaz?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Diaz, thank you for your testimony. Are you paying child support for your daughter currently?
No, I'm not.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Diaz. Lawrence Gorin.
morning, Chair McPhear, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Boren. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been a member of the bar for some 30 years, general family law practice. Over the years, I have been an attorney of record on a number of paternity cases on both sides of this issue. And a number of years, the Oregon State Bar asked me to author a chapter in the continuing legal education handbook that the bar publishes on family law, and I've been doing that for about the past 10 years. I seem to be called on by attorneys all over the state on a regular basis to answer questions and discuss various cases dealing with paternity law, and I was a member of the OLC work group. I happen to agree with most of the proposal that the OLC has produced, with several exceptions, and that's what I wanted to discuss today. Mr. Minahan contacted me and asked me to review his -2 amendments, and I accommodated that request with criticism and critique and came up with some alternative language, which I understand has been distributed to you in the form of the attachment to the Dad's America packet materials. And essentially, if I can just review those, the first one deals with a very perhaps technical matter dealing with the wording that the OLC's proposal has, and this deals with Section 1 of the bill at subsection 5F. The OLC bill, as it is written in a rather interesting way. There's been some prior discussion about giving the court discretion. This deals with a situation where there's been a paternity acknowledgement and a petition is being filed with a court to set it aside on the basis of fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact. The OLC wording would suggest that the court may set aside the acknowledgement if the court finds that it is just and equitable to the parties and the child to do so, and the court finds that by preponderance of the evidence that the acknowledgement was signed because of fraud, duress, or a material mistake of fact. If you take a close look at that language, what it really means, recasting it, is that if the court finds that it is just and equitable to the parties to do so, also finds, by preponderance of the evidence, that the acknowledgement was signed by fraud, duress, material mistake of fact, then the court may set aside the acknowledgement. So in essence, it really gives the court far more than discretionary authority to set it aside if it's just and equitable to do so. In fact, that language, as OLC has it written, would in fact allow the court to deny the requested relief for any reason whatsoever. Rather than saying, you know, two things have to be established. Number one, under the OLC proposal, the court must find that it's just and equitable to do so. The court must also find that the acknowledgement statement was signed under fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact. If those two prerequisite foundational elements are established, then the court may, but does not have to, set it aside. And my feeling is that that gives the court too much discretion, and the suggestion, therefore, is to revise it. Traditionally, in our system of justice, if you're asking relief from the court and you prove your case, then you ought to be entitled to get the relief you're seeking, unless there's some reason to deny that requested relief. So the alternative language that I would suggest simply says that if the court finds, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the acknowledgement was signed as a result of fraud, duress, or a material mistake of fact, the court shall set aside the acknowledgement, unless the court finds that it would be unjust or inequitable to the parties and the child to do so. So the discretionary element is still there, but once the petitioning party has established that the document was signed by fraud, duress, or result of fraud, duress, material mistake of fact, then the court shall grant the relief that's being requested unless the court finds that it would be unjust or inequitable to do so. So that was the issue, the first issue, and recommended revision. expanding that subsection, consistent with what Mr. Minahan was proposing, his dash 2 amendment originally talked about a situation where the challenge to the voluntary acknowledgement is being brought by a man who signed the acknowledgement. And I looked at that and discussing it with others also felt that there might be a somewhat of an equal application of a law problem there, restricting it to only the man who signed it. Also a belief that if the petitioning party is a person who signed it, and it is established that it was signed as a result of fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact, and blood tests establish that indeed the male party who signed that document is not the father of the child, at that point, having proven those elements, that the petitioning party ought to be entitled to the request of relief in that situation, absent compelling and specific and compelling reasons, a little bit more than unjust or inequitable. It essentially, without using the word presumption, indeed creates somewhat of a presumption in the favor of a petitioning party if that person is one who signed the document. So the expanded and revised language would say that however, if the challenge is brought by a person who signed the acknowledgement, and the court finds that by preponderance of the evidence that the person bringing the challenge signed the acknowledgement as a result of fraud, duress, material mistake, and blood tests, as defined otherwise in the statute, prove that the male signer is not the biological father, the court shall set aside the acknowledgement and render a judgment of non-paternity, unless the court finds and declares specific and compelling reasons based on the evidence presented for not doing so. There's still a discretionary factor, but again, it calls on the court to make a finding and declaration of specific and compelling reasons for not granting the requested relief.
Hey, Mr. Gorin, I'd like to just break in here just because I want to manage the flow. We actually had another bill that had several people had shown up to testify on that I was hoping to get to today, and we've got several more witnesses on this bill. And I'd say you're starting to penetrate fairly deeply into the text here, at least for my grasp of the issues here. So I wonder if you could, this bill is not going to move today, and so I wonder if you could maybe summarize your perspectives on the bill at sort of a more sort of surface level here for the benefit of the committee, and then we'll kind of gather the other input, and then I think this bill will continue to be worked further.
Thank you, yes. Essentially, the approach that I would have is somewhat of a middle ground approach between what Dads America is recommending and what OLC is recommending. And that is, in those situations where you've got a male individual who is proven to be not the father, and the requested relief from that judgment and the burden imposed by those paternity judgments, the requested relief is being made by either the mother of the child or by the man who has been found to be the father of the child as a result of fraud, and it's proven that he's not the father. Then in that situation, as I've just explained, compelling and specific and compelling reasons would be required to be found by the court. And if that's for not setting it aside, it just tilts the table somewhat in favor of the individual who's seeking relief from the court. And that essentially is it. To go any further would be, as you've just indicated, Chair McPherson, it would be going into a far deep and technical argument, which we need not do, I think, at this point.
Right. I think what we need to do now is sort of sort out the broader policy issues and then figure where we go in terms of working detail.
In essence, in summary, basically what I was trying to do is to come up with a middle ground compromise proposal. I realize the OLC, and as a member of that work group, there were, I think, about 20 meetings or so. I attended every one of them and had some disagreements. We did a lot of compromising, and a good job was done. But I think that it needs to be a little bit more balanced than the final work product of the work group. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Gorin. Maureen McKnight.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Maureen McKnight. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County, and I practice exclusively family law. I do some domestic violence in the criminal arena, but it's becoming more exclusively family law again. Just by way of just very brief background, prior to my taking the bench, I spent 26 years in Oregon's legal services programs, and one of my areas of specialty was the state child support program. And I have been involved in some of the legislation and policy initiatives affecting paternity in the past, and I agree with Representative Krieger's astute observation that there hasn't been a comprehensive look, and it's been these piecemeal sorts of attempts to answer individual sorts of problems. I'm testifying today for the Judicial Department, but essentially just on the one issue of the judicial discretion, which is the backdrop for the policy dispute that faces this committee. And I wanted to make two points in particular. One is that you've all heard about how our current statutes are piecemeal and hodgepodge, and I just want to emphasize how little not just lawyers but judges understand about the operation of our paternity challenge laws now, and that the commission product has gone a long way to providing the clarity about procedures and standards that that don't exist now. And you've also heard about the numbers of unrepresented litigants. More than half the cases I handle in any family law matter involve litigants who don't have attorneys. And I agreed very strongly with the child support program about the necessity to set up procedures that those individuals can access and make good use of. But turning to the primary point, which is really the one that we're dealing here with, a court of equity. We're dealing not just with facts, but with fairness. And we've heard this morning of testimony concerning fraud and very harmful fraud, situations that create very unfortunate and deplorable situations for people. We've also heard of situations where there have been mistakes, and I wanted to stress that as well, that a lot of the issues that I see in paternity challenges are actual mistakes as opposed to fraud. There clearly are situations where people have intentionally lied in terms of their statements about whether someone is the father or, frankly, whether a male is sterile. We've had those cases, and it works both ways in terms of statements made. But it is certainly, I don't disagree with Mr. Minahan that in terms of the bulk of the cases that have to do with misrepresentation have involved statements by mothers, but I also wanted to stress there's a very significant component of mistake cases where women don't know, unfortunately, who the father is and make their best guess, and there's reliance on it, and we go from there. Some of the prior witnesses were talking about if you can prove your case that you should win, talking, and Mr. Gorin just spoke about tilting the table in favor of the petitioner. And I guess the main point I wanted to make in my presentation is that I believe the choice for this committee is to decide whether to tilt or whether to leave the discretion as broad as possible for the court to consider all of the factors without assigning any sort of preference to the issue of biology, without assigning any sort of preference to the issue of someone was defrauded, and looking at all of the issues in their totality without assigning a particular weight to any one of them. And that's the kind of discretion I'm asking you to give me as the trier. And let me just give you one brief scenario that was one of my cases, where a mother knowingly misrepresented to her boyfriend his paternity, and she assured him that he was the father, and she denied having sexual relations with anyone else. He signed a voluntary acknowledgement at the hospital. When the child was three, the male learned that the mother had lied to him. The child had cerebral palsy and had, and had substantial treatment expenses, and the child lived with the mother. The male at that point was seeing the child occasionally at his own mother's home, at grandmother's home, because the child was visiting the paternal grandmother very regularly. And the male wasn't paying any support. The child called the man daddy and asked his grandmother about him. These are not cut and dried cases. These are not situations that call out for preferences for biology, that call out for preferences against biology. They're cases that require triers to consider each different scenario and assign the weight that the judgment of the trier feels appropriate in terms of all the circumstances. We heard about you can't draft specifically for each individual case, that these are complicated, hard cases, and I can tell you that these are the toughest cases for me. It is harder to do this than almost anything else when I'm trying to weigh which are competing equities, and this committee certainly has the prerogative to set strictures for triers on whether to weight certain elements, and it would be my job to follow those restrictions if you so codify a bill that restricts my discretion in some way, and I will do that. But I want to submit to you that I really believe it's the broader discretion. We're not in a two-party dynamic. We're in a third-party dynamic. There is a child to consider, and it's not just a question of making someone who's been defrauded whole. Quite often there is a disestablishment, and in this case that I'm quoting to you, there was a disestablishment. A paternity finding was set aside. But I want to point out that they're difficult cases, and I'm asking that you give me as many tools as you can in terms of using my judgment in various scenarios. And I'll try to end with that since I know you have other witnesses. Unless there's any questions.
Any questions for Judge McKnight? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again, Judge. I just wanted to comment that I know we have some tough decisions to make, but I don't know whose is tougher, ours or the judges in these cases. So thank you for the work that you do.
Well, thank you on behalf of the Judicial Department, but I do want to stress this committee, and I have been on other Oregon law committees, worked particularly hard on an extremely difficult issue, and our chair deserves a lot of credit.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. We have three more witnesses signed up, and I'd like to move fairly promptly along if we could, as I want to get to one more bill. And for those of you who came for, if there is anybody here for House Bills 2225 and 2226, I think it's pretty clear we're not going to get to those bills today. But I do want to get up to be here 2257. But let's, continuing with our hearing on 2382. Next up is Kathy Graham.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson and committee. I have copies of my testimony that's prepared. If you'd like to circulate them, and I can just be very brief and
thank
just
you.
Summarize what I wanted to say and then answer any questions that you might have. I was a member of the work group.
And please begin by identifying yourself formally for the record.
Oh, yes. I'm Kathy Graham, and I'm a professor at Willamette Law School, and I've taught family law for many years, too, along with Leslie Harris, and I was also a member of the Oregon Law Commission work group that worked on this project. And I'm joined by several other professors from other law schools that you can see listed at the top of this of my prepared testimony, who also wanted to express their concern express their favor for Dash 1, the original bill that was that is being proposed by the Oregon Law Commission. And I just basically have a couple of points that have been made by others today, and I'll just underscore them. I guess our concern with Dash 2, first of all, would be that it makes a distinction, draws a distinction between the man who would contest a voluntary acknowledgement or a judgment of paternity or an administrative determination of paternity and treats others differently. And kind of leaving that aside for a moment and kind of just taking that as a problem, I won't even talk about that in any more detail. Our biggest concern, the other professors and myself, is that we, kind of underscoring what others have said, believe that in particular, paternity actions are ones where the court should have that kind of broad discretion that Judge McKnight has just talked about. And to deprive the court of that discretion and not allow the court to do what's just and equitable in this very narrow set of cases where, according to Dash 2, a case of fraud or mistake of fact would have been made out, we think is wrong and does damage to the process. And I give you an example in my testimony of just one circumstance where you might assume that, you know, this could be, a case for which this issue would come up. It's on page 2 of my testimony, where you assume that a man who signed a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity and held himself out as the father of the child for 10 years later learned that he is not the biological father and brings an action to set aside the acknowledgement on the basis of fraud or material mistake of fact, whichever it might be. If the court finds a material mistake of fact or fraud, the court must set aside, according to the language in Dash 2, and cannot then look at what is just and equitable as it would be in other kinds of fact circumstances when someone else brought the same kind of action. And assuming for a moment, as I did in my fact scenario here, that the child had had a relationship with that father for a long period of time, it might be very damaging to that relationship and to that child to do that kind of thing without being able to take into consideration what is just and equitable. So on behalf of the law professors, we urge you to think about retaining and adopt Dash 1 and allow that kind of discretion to apply in all of these cases involving involuntary acknowledgement and involving judgments of paternity. The other thing that I would say is that the definitions of fraud and material mistake of fact that are included in that Section 1 are defined in a way that I think makes it very confusing in terms of just how that term has been used broadly in Oregon law. I mean, the terms fraud and material mistake of fact are throughout Oregon law and are used in the common law, are used in case law, and are used in other statutes. I think it's going to be very confusing. It's not even clear in the context of the entire act whether that definition would apply in other sections of the act. So I think to define it in that way is going to create a lot of confusion. So that's another reason why we would favor adopting Dash 1. And then finally, I guess I'd say on behalf of other members of the work group, myself, and I guess I speak on behalf of the other law professors as well, I think Dash 1 represents a fragile kind of compromise. And people today have testified to how many hours of work and how much work was done by all of us to get to the point where we could propose Dash 1. Dash 2, I think, is something that takes away that compromise. I don't think I can speak for the group that we would not be in favor of that Dash 2, nor I think would we necessarily favor Dash 3, which is being suggested today as another way to make sure that we have a compromise or to try to further the goals that were part of the compromise that we reached during the process. Dash 1's the one in terms of representing, I think, what all of us work together to reach in terms of a consensus about what we think the language should be. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but basically those are my main points.
Any questions for Professor Gray?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. You said you would not favor the Dash 3s. Can you tell me why not?
Well, I think that, you know, I've just seen Dash 3 just briefly this morning, but the way I read it, it takes away some of the discretion and makes the discretion available to the judge in making a determination about overturning a voluntary acknowledgement on a narrower basis. For example, I believe that language that was just read would not allow the judge or doesn't speak to allowing the judge look at what is fair and equitable and doesn't say anything about considering the interests of the child in terms of looking at issues at the time that the motion is made or a petition is made to overturn the voluntary acknowledgement. So the discretion, I believe, is going to be much narrower. That would be one reason why it would not favor the Dash 3s.
There are no further questions then. Thank you, Professor.
Well, we don't have.
Unless you had something further, Representative Cameron?
Recommended. Well, I was just trying to read the language that she referred to here real quick.
The language, I think, as I understand it, is Section 1 there, subsection 5F. Now, that's the language that's being proposed in the dash 3. And I believe that language is, well, it is narrower than, it's much more limited discretion on the part of the court in terms of making its decision about whether or not to overturn the voluntary acknowledgement. And as I said before, I mean, family law is an area that traditionally has been one which has accommodated a great deal of discretion on the part of the courts, support issues, custody issues, issues involving guardianship. Many of the family law issues that we've talked about today are areas where courts traditionally have had a lot of discretion to do what they believe is fair, what's in the best interest of children in some contexts, and I believe that that language is taking some of that away. So I would favor the dash ones.
Yeah, I just want to read what the language said here. If I'm looking at the right, in Mr. Gorin's testimony on the last page, the language is recommending except as provided in subsection 8 of this section, unless the court finds that it is unjust or inequitable. So doesn't that give the court the flexibility to find it unjust or inequitable? This is his recommended
are you
language.
From what, section 9?
Subsection 7 on the last page is revised to read as follows, the recommended dash 3s.
I'm sorry, I don't have his testimony, so I'm not able to comment. I don't have the precise
follow-up. So have you seen the recommended dash 3s yet?
I guess I'm seeing it right now.
Representative, I guess the at this point, I think what we want to get is the broader kind of policy questions aired, and then maybe have an opportunity then before the bill.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there was a reference to the dash 3s and that we were going to oppose them. So I'm just bringing up a point that how can we oppose a dash 3 amendment if we don't know what the dash 3 is? That's my point. I'll be quiet.
Would get this any move off of the dash ones that this witness opposes. I think that's what's Cushy's trying to get across to us. Any further questions? Thank you, Professor. Next is Ronell Schenkel.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. Committee staff are passing out my written testimony, so I'll try to be brief. I'm here today in support of the Dash 1 amendments. The Department of Justice had several representatives on this Law Commission work group, several of them being attorneys. Our primary focus were the services that we provide and the resulting impact to child support services and to the Department of Human Services child welfare services. As you've heard from previous testimony, a lot of legal and scientific changes have occurred over the years. And the other thing I want to highlight, having a background in child support, is that family dynamics continue to change and have changed drastically over the years since these laws were written. And that puts the issue in the forefront before us today. I do want to comment ever so briefly based on some of the personal testimony by constituents earlier. In the 1970s, we were not the child support program. We were the welfare recovery division. And the only thing we were tasked with was obtaining recoveries for state assistance. So it was a very different time. And in the 1977, all paternity actions were judicial actions in court. It wasn't until the 80s that we obtained the administrative process, and it wasn't until 1977 that you gave us voluntary acknowledgments in the law. So the laws have changed drastically over the years, and there have been a lot of improvements. We're not all the way there, which is why you have the bill in front of you today. I've been a legislative liaison for the department for the past 5 sessions. This topic is not new. It may be new to you, but there have been several attempts to move a bill forward, and no consensus has been reached until this date. Last year, as Representative Krieger and Matt Minahan both mentioned, Senate Bill 234, and it was actually amendments to that bill, did take us a step forward and serve as a catalyst for this topic. It was the Department of Justice, and Representative Krieger is correct. I was in his office. I remember it well. And I informed him that the Department of Justice had already made a proposal to the Oregon Law Commission asking them to take on this topic. That proposal by our department was made in 2004, and ultimately this work group was formed that you're hearing about today. This has been a knowledgeable committee. It was very diverse. You've heard a lot of information about that, so I will not go into it. But that is why we are here today in support of the Dash 1 version as the consensus amendments.
Any questions for Ms. Schenkel? Thank you, Ms. Schenkel. And finally, our last signed up witness is Sybil Hepp.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center. Sorry for the rush. In the interest of time, I'll keep my testimony short. I wanted to testify briefly in favor of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2382 and convey to you that the Oregon Law Center, which is a representative nonprofit statewide law firm whose concerns are for the interests of low-income Oregonians, was a member of the work group that participated in this discussion. And Karen Berkowitz, who is my colleague, was a member, and I was an advisor to the committee. And we attended and participated and are supportive of the compromise that was hashed out by the committee over the course of more than a year. We appreciate the Dash 1's consideration of the interests of unrepresented litigants and low-income litigants in making some of these procedures more accessible to people. Very much appreciate that, and also appreciate the balance of interests that we think the Dash 1 strikes in terms of recognizing that the interests of the child necessarily have to be considered in making some of these determinations. And we appreciate the preservation of some flexibility so as to allow the courts to address the specific circumstances of individual cases. Further, I want to just stress one concern, which is that I believe that the Dash 1s do a good job of addressing fraud and misrepresentation separately from material mistake of fact, and I think we have a concern whenever those concepts are lumped together because they do present such different circumstances and are really significantly about very different things. And specifically, when people are unrepresented or struggling with procedures by themselves, they may have mistakes or not understand consequences of actions and wouldn't want that to be treated in the same circumstances as actual purposeful knowing fraud or misrepresentation. So with that, I just want to express my support for the process and my appreciation for the great work of the committee and support of the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you, Ms. Hedges.
Thank you.
If there are no questions, then Representative Krieger, did you have a...
I just had one little concern, a little maybe disappointment when I hear from the judges. I spent 28 years in the courtroom, and I can tell you that discretion didn't always lend itself to justice. I might make it also make you go back and remember that it was this discretion that got us Measure 11.
Okay, if there are no further questions or comments, then I'm going to close the public hearing. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, President.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. For the record, I just want to make a comment that if somehow in the future, not now, that we would be remiss in not talking about the needs of children of same-sex partners.
Thank you, Representative. Then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2382. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2257. And Commissioner Dan Gardner has been very patient about waiting through this last bill. And I do want to at least get this topic introduced to the committee. Commissioner, thank you very much for your long wait in getting to this important bill.
I know.
I'm happy to do it. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is Marsha Oldley Miller, my legal policy advisor. Also, for the record, House Bill 2257 has nothing to do with child custody. This bill, if passed, would clarify the non-competition agreements are unenforceable if an employee loses their job as a result of rounds of layoffs. current law, ORS 653-295, describes the parameters of when an employer may require an employee to sign a non-competition agreement. Non-competition agreements limit where and when an employee may work after termination of employment. The law doesn't currently provide relief for an individual who signed this type of agreement when the individual is laid off through no fault of their own versus discharge for cause. Some of the key points of the legislation is that there's small change. This is a small change in Oregon statute. This bill would only affect a small number of Oregon workers subject to economic layoffs after having signed a non-competition agreement with their employer. This bill defines layoff for purposes of the bill and clarifies that under circumstances, non-competition agreements between employer and employees are void. Layoff is defined as permanent termination of an employment relationship for reasons that are beyond the employee's control and that do not reflect discredit upon the employee. Reasons for layoff include but are not limited to the elimination of the employee's position, lack of available funding for work, reduction in the size of the workplace, and change in the workplace that affects staffing needs. When we're comparing Oregon with other states in relation to non-competition clauses, we find only 5 states have higher levels of enforceability of non-competition agreement. More importantly, the 2 states with the largest cluster of high-tech companies, California and Texas, outright ban non-competition clauses. In my opinion, this is really a question of fairness. We should not allow employers to restrict the future employment of employees by enforcing non-competition agreements in cases when the employee, when the employer has laid off the employee. A key element used by the courts to decide these cases is a standard of reasonableness. That is, the agreement's reasonable in scope. Well, in cases where an employee loses their job because of an economic decision made on the part of the employer, their non-competition agreement is unreasonable on its face. The economy is a dramatic and upward and downward swing. In fact, several large high-tech companies in Oregon recently have laid off hundreds of workers, and this bill would be a step to try to protect Oregon workers whose employment are affected and forces that are outside of their control. You'll likely hear from some of the high technology sectors today, and their concern that limiting non-competition agreements in any way is a threat of their ability to protect trade secrets. I would respectfully say that this argument's a red herring, that there are other forces in law that protect trade secrets, and those are fully protected. This is about the ability of a company to restrict an employee's future employment options based solely on their knowledge and ability. In addition, I also like to point out to the committee again that the highest number of technologies firms of high tech are in California and in Texas, where non-competition agreements are totally outlawed. Yet high technology companies in these states continue to prosper. And in fact, some studies show that the industry actually benefits from the movement of workers in the high technologies industry. I'd ask the committee if it's good enough for the Silicon Valley to outright ban non-competition agreements. Why is it not good enough for the Silicon Forest to ban only those where it's a case where the employee was laid off? Concerning a large number of whether non-competition agreements are beneficial or not, there's a number of studies that show adverse effects when non-competition agreements are in, including lower research and development, lower in executive compensation, managers that are less likely to invest in the intellectual capital of the firm. There's a significant decrease in executive mobility, and there's also an employee doesn't change and move firms, they are all but guaranteed a lower post-transfer wage. I'd really urge this the committee to pass this bill as an incremental step toward fairness for skilled workers. we're really talking about young people here that we tell to go to college, to get a degree, to have a career. They have one, and they're not allowed once they leave a company through no fault of their own to continue to pursue their own profession. Many people will tell you that these agreements are not enforceable unless you go to court, and that is well true. However, technologies industry, as an example, is a small family of firms in the state of Oregon, and one of the first questions you'd be asked when you move from one to another is if you have an enforced non-competition agreement, and you'd probably progress no farther in the employment process once you said yes. Also, it's been suggested that an amendment to this bill should be for CEOs, CFOs, and members of the board of directors. I find that to be a friendly amendment and be happy to add that in as well. With that, I think Marcia has a couple of comments. We'd be happy to answer your questions.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Olemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. And what I want to point out is the statute that House Bill 2257 would amend, ORS 653-295, has not just non-competition agreements in it, but another kind of agreement called a bonus restriction agreement. This bill would not affect bonus restriction agreements. The distinction is a bonus restriction agreement would be for an employee who is a manager in the position in which they sign the agreement. They have customer contact. They have knowledge of trade secrets. The bonus restriction agreement applies to the employee only and not in employment with future employers. In other words, if you go out in business on your own, it would apply. And the penalty of a bonus restriction agreement is limited to the forfeiture of the bonus. So in other words, there's an amount of money set up that if you violate the bonus restriction agreement, you lose that. Non-competition agreements, on the other hand, under the current statute, could be much more broadly applied to non-management employees who would not have to have knowledge of trade secrets, would not have to have had customer contact. It would apply to them as they go into employment with another employer. It would prevent that employment if they were working in the same or similar field. And just point out the generality of the language about non-competition agreements. Under the current statute, it says the employee under a non-competition agreement would not compete in providing products, processes, or services similar to those of the employer. So that's pretty broad. And so the circumstances under which an employee might be asked to sign a non-competition agreement are much broader, and that employee is in a less powerful bargaining position than an employee who would be eligible to sign a bonus restriction agreement. So again, this bill would not affect bonus restriction agreements. It would affect non-competition agreements so that if you were laid off, the non-competition agreement would not be able to be enforced by a court.
Any Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Gardner, for your testimony, although your opening statement I'm not quite sure I agree with, because I could definitely see somebody working who's your daddy into this bill. But I actually have a real question, and that's I got an email from somebody who's very concerned about customer contacts and salespeople with customer contacts. Is that an issue that you covered under the same trade secret rules that you mentioned in your testimony?
Well, trade secret rules are not, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, trade secret legislation is not affected by this legislation. So if you have in a customer service area, some form of trade secrets, it's protected in other forms of law.
Thank you.
Thank you, and it will be very quick, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Gardner. In proposing the statutory change, have you had discussions or meetings with employers from around Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I have introduced this bill two or three sessions now, and during those times I have had discussions with representatives from employers around the state, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, then let's excuse this panel and bring forward Jack Isselman and Jim Craven.
Morning.
morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, Oregon Council. AEA is the nation's largest high-tech trade association, and we have 180 member companies here in Oregon. Foremost, I think any proposed substantial change in longstanding employment law ought to be accompanied with a clear statement of the compelling public policy reason for that change. We've heard sort of general statements about why this is good public policy, but I have been last session and this session surveying my member companies in the high-tech field, asking them their opinion about this, and I haven't seen evidence, not that it doesn't exist, but evidence of widespread abuse or evidence of people who could not get out of a non-compete if it was judged to be unreasonable, etc. I just haven't seen that evidence in Oregon. My member companies tell me that companies only attempt to enforce non-competition agreements when they believe there is a significant threat to the company's competitiveness. Primarily, I'm told, that's because the courts are reluctant to uphold such agreements on the grounds that they could unreasonably preclude an individual from earning a living in his or her chosen field. To the essence of this bill specifically, many of my members have commented that they're concerned about the unintended consequences of allowing a layoff, which is defined in sort of a new fashion for this bill, to void a non-competition agreement. One of my members wrote that there is nothing inherent in a layoff that suggests the employer no longer has the protectable interest that caused it to bargain for the non-comp in the first place. And just to remind you that these are not imposed upon employees after they accept employment. They can only be entered into prior to employment or at the time of a significant promotion on the job. So they're not, people don't take work and then have this foisted upon them. It's part of a exchange of value at the time of employment. One of my folks who is a company CEO said that sir, there's a perverse angle to this bill, that if a non-compete were to be voided upon a layoff only, but not upon a voluntary separation or a termination for cause, what could happen is that a person who wanted to compete with their current company could seek to be, quote, incompetent enough to get laid off, but not incompetent enough to be fired for cause. So employers, contrarywise, will begin looking for reasons to lay somebody off for cause so that they can protect their non-competition agreement. But if they lay somebody off and treat them gently and don't contest their unemployment and maybe even help them find another job, they lose their protectable interest. So it's sort of a strange, I think, a mixed message that we send to employers. I've talked to some of our large manufacturing firms that were referenced by the commissioner and didn't find any evidence that hundreds of hourly workers are being laid off and then held to non-compete agreements and not being allowed to work in the Portland metropolitan area. I just couldn't find evidence of that among my members. Though we have some very small, very high-tech, leading-edge companies that use non-competes with their employees out of a fear that a competitor could simply come in and try to lift their entire workforce out from under them. Those key 8 to 10 people that are the heart and soul of the company could just be picked up and moved to a competitive firm. There was a comment about the trade secrets part, and we acknowledge that even if this bill were to pass as written, that there is another section of law that allows employers to protect trade secrets and other proprietary information. But following up on the question from Representative Bonamici, we're not sure that that covers everything. Key customer lists, customer data, customer information, strategic information about the company. There's a question whether the phrase trade secrets or other proprietary information is broad enough to give people, comfort in that. As best I can tell, the overall enforceability of these agreements rests upon judgments of reasonableness, as the commissioner pointed out. And it's difficult to argue that employees are being arbitrary precluded from being able to make a living in the Portland area. In fact, on Bully's own website, there's a set of statements that describe just because you sign one of these does not mean that it's enforceable. And it talks about legitimate interest of the employer. Is it too restrictive in terms of duration or geography? Basically, the courts, and what I'm told by those in the legal community, the courts err on the side of the ability of somebody to work. And nobody wants people who are lose a job because of economic reasons to be precluded from going to work in the community. And I don't think that's the intention. I think these are done judiciously with key employees. And we're not sure that we find a compelling reason to make this change. And we think the specifics of this bill about creating this new idea of layoff opens a lot of issues for those in the employment law that probably need to be heard from, in addition to me, who is an amateur in this area. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Craven? Isselman.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. For the record, my name is Jack Isselman. I'm an attorney with the Tock and Torp Law Firm, and I'm here today representing the Software Association of Oregon. We are Oregon's largest locally based technology trade association with over 500 member companies in the state. Today we join AEA, Oregon Council, in its opposition to House Bill 2257. And I'll briefly add 2 points to Mr. Craven's statement. First of all, by way of background, before I commenced my advocacy career before this assembly, I spent the better part of a decade advising corporate clients, and in that capacity observed the entry of hundreds of these agreements. I've only seen one enforced one time, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a moment. First, one point I want to make is that frequently a non-compete provision is embedded within a broader employment agreement that also includes important confidentiality protections. The way this bill is drafted leaves open to doubt whether or not entire employment agreements entered into in arm's length fashion, as Mr. Craven indicated, would be voided as a result of having one or two sentences related to non-competition agreements. So I caution the committee about the breadth of the scope of this particular measure. Secondly, on the issue of enforcement of these agreements, the definition of layoff in the bill is of some concern, and in particular the fact that it does not provide that an employer has to be the one who's terminating the employment. And here's where that becomes relevant. As I mentioned, I was involved in one time in enforcing one of these agreements. It was with a gifted but restless young PhD at the technology company where I served as general counsel. He was frustrated with the fact that my client's weakening financial condition required us to reduce his research and development budget. He was charged with managing the development of a very important entry into a new market for our company. Ultimately, he quit. We did an exit interview. We had him bring his inventor logbooks forward to us. And those inventor logbooks are the basis of all patent applications. We told him he did not need to tell us where he was going for future employment. He volunteered that he was going to work for a venture capitalist in Ireland. About 2 months after he left, we observed that several logbooks that were the basis of the patented research that we had financed were missing. We sent him a letter to follow up, assuming that this was a mere oversight. Subsequently, we learned from customers that our former PhD researcher was working for a VC, but in fact he was a staff scientist supporting one of those venture capitalist portfolio companies that was directly competing in this nascent marketplace that was very important to us. We proceeded to use both the confidentiality provisions and the non-compete provisions in his agreement. We were able to negotiate a settlement which allowed him to continue to work for his employer but safeguarded our intellectual property that had been the subject of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of investment. Without the agreement, without that contract, had we been left only to our statutory rights, I believe enforcing Oregon statutory rights against an employee who had gone to Ireland would have been extraordinarily difficult. That agreement was essential to our ability to protect our investment in our intellectual property. So I caution you around this definition of layoff, because if you see at section 7C, reasons for a layoff include, but are not limited to, a lack of available funding for work. Now, that is a very subjective criteria, and I submit to you that any company that's going through any significant reduction of force is going to have a lack of available funding for certain people's projects. If they quit, is that a layoff? This measure doesn't make that clear. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. I'm happy to receive any questions.
Any questions for the panel? I think people are exhausted by our long agenda, so thank you much for coming in. We will excuse this panel and close the public hearing on House Bill 2257. That concludes as much of the agenda as we're going to complete today. Committee, thank you for sticking around. Watch for the online notice about whether we had not scheduled any bills for tomorrow, and I need to determine whether any of the bills we did not get to today will be set for tomorrow. We did not have anything on the agenda for tomorrow, so watch for the online notice. We are adjourned.